The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, listeners, this episode of the Battlestar Galactic cast may feature spoilers for events that come later on in the series. So be warned.
Be warned.
All ministers and officials should now go to Case Orange. Repeat, this is an official colonial government broadcast.
Hello and welcome to the Battlestar Galacticast special bonus edition brought to you by Sci-Fi Wire. My name is Mark Bernardin.
And I am Trisha Helfer.
We have in the house a special guest who we will get to in just a second. But this is the last proper version of the Battlestar Galacticast. We did the finale last week or last month, or I'm not sure how they're going to release this. But we did the finale.
And we both cried.
And there was tears.
We're not going to cry in this one.
I don't think so. And also the tears were prompted in great effect by Mary McDonnell having been our guest. And so talking to Mary always brings one to the verge of emotional collapse anyway. So we were already compromised. But this time we are going to talk about The Plan, which is a aberration as far as I can tell TV-wise in the, hey, a show's over. You know what, though? People love this show, and they will totally take more of this show. And if we can figure out a way to give it to them in ways they didn't quite expect, then let's do so. And also spend a boatload of money.
Four seasons in a movie. It's just it was an MOW movie.
Which leads me to the question, or a question, which I can ask our guest, who we've wanted on.
Yes. Trying to get this guest on for what seems to be like a year and a half.
I'm a hard get.
The hardest of hard gets. And a mixture of just like schedule inconsistencies. We're like transatlantic time zone jumping and, you know, pandemic, you know, anxieties and all of it have barred this person from gracing our microphones. But we got her because this is the last chance we had to get
right.
Welcome, everybody. Jane Espenson.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
Oh, the great and wonderful, mighty Jane Espenson. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm surviving. As we're recording this, it's like how many days till the election? Four or five? So these are anxious times for everyone.
They are indeed. You know, yeah. We won't exhort anybody to, well, this will air post inauguration. So hope you voted, everybody. You know, exercise your franchise as an American citizen and do that.
And thankfully, this movie, MOW, was not about an election. It wasn't one of the election episodes.
That's right.
Because I think it would have been too hard to handle and do it this particular week that we're taping this.
Yeah, we've stumbled into, especially in quarantine, a weird zone of, oh, here's the episode that's about a pandemic. Right. All right, sure, let's talk about it. This isn't too on the nose.
Oh, or Baltar's just not cut out to be president.
Yeah. But luckily, we are, as you listen to this, on the other side of an election. So at the very least, no more election ads on your television. Hopefully we are not careening towards a double down on a hellscape. But who knows? We can't see the future, unlike Battlestar, which totally could. So I think, you know, I'm gonna press play on The Plan, which was written by Jane Espenson and directed by one Edward James Olmos.
That's right.
you know, that guy. And then we will kind of get into it a little bit with just your history with Battlestar.
Yeah.
Like, tell us a little bit about how you ended up on the show to begin with.
Oh, boy. Well, I go way back with Ron Moore, probably further back than any of the other writers on Battlestar, because when I was in grad school in Berkeley, I started going down to pitch episode ideas at Star Trek Next Generation. And I would do that a couple times a year. And they made the lower level writers listen to the pitches from the eager grad students like me that would show up. And Ron Moore was the young writer I would go in and pitch to sometimes. So when I discovered Battlestar Galactica as a fan and realized I was free to staff, I knew it was the show I wanted to go on. And I said, told my agent, like, reach out to Ron, see if he remembers me from back in the day. And got in to pitch. And I turned that into a staff job.
Awesome. Now, were you one of the next gen hopefuls who submitted episodes? Like, did you write a spec and submit it into the slush pile?
I submitted three. I got three episodes in that slush pile. And episode two is the one where they called me and said, okay, we like this one. You can come in and pitch.
Nice.
Yeah.
See,
I never got one. I ended up ultimately getting a story credit on an episode, but I never got to write one.
Yeah. I mean, for you listeners at home who don't know about this, Star Trek, The Next Generation, and subsequently DS9, I'm not sure if it extended all the way to Voyager or not, but was like the only show on television that had an open submission policy. Yeah. Which meant that if you were an aspiring writer and you wrote a spec screenplay, a spec episode of Star Trek and mailed it to them, they'd read it. Like, they'd consider it. And if they liked it and they thought you had talent, they'd call you up. Like, they'd call Jane and either buy it or invite you to pitch more. But it doesn't exist anymore. You can't do that anymore.
No. And you couldn't do it then. It was the only show that still had that. I mean, I think that back in the day that had been sort of the policy that freelance writers anyway, maybe not amateurs, but freelance writers would sort of make the circuits all season long, pitching ideas and meeting on shows to get freelance gigs. And that went away. That had sort of already was disappearing when Trek still had it going. So it was wonderful.
I feel like it was a vestige of Michael Piller having been on like Columbo and Ironsides. And because that's how TV was done. There weren't staffs per se. There was a bunch of just kind of gunslingers who would come in and pitch their take on Scarecrow and Mrs. King.
That's right.
And that's how television was made. And Star Trek was the tail end of that. And the sort of at the same time, the beginning of we're hiring these dozen people to come in and tell these stories.
That's right. And it was also a necessity because even at that time, at the time they were doing Star Trek TNG, they already felt like they were in danger of running out of stories, even from just original Trek and the new stories they were doing on TNG. You look back so many, you know, now two decades later, like they really need an open door policy. It's a show like that's it's idea driven. You need people coming in.
Yeah. For sure. And so, okay, so Star Trek was your connection to Ron.
Yeah.
And Ron apparently remembered you from back in the day and was
he
like,
did.
Yeah, come Jane, come and play in Battlestar with us.
That's right. And he gave me a freelance episode in season three. So the last vestiges of the freelance system. and then put me on staff in season four. So I was really only on staff for one season. But then this thing, the plan, was sort of post season four. So I got a little bonus time tucked on at the end.
Excellent.
Do you remember if there was the idea to do the plan? Kind of, when did it come into fruition?
It was not hugely anticipated. It was probably the middle of season four, which the middle of season four was all spongy because there was the writer's strike. So when was the middle? So I can't remember if it was, I think it was already being discussed before the strike. And David and Bradley were going to write it, Weddle and Thompson. Mm-hmm. And they had actually worked up a rough beat sheet, I think, of what should be covered in it. And then by the time I was doing it, they were off on their next job. I was the person who was still around and available, and it sort of got handed to me. So I took on the job of scripting it out. And then there were a, it changed a great deal because like Katie wasn't available and President Roslin wasn't available, Mary wasn't available. So I, it had, a lot had to change.
So yeah, from, go ahead.
If you came on near, you know, you, like you said, for one season, a little over one season, did you, I assume you had gone back and watched all the episodes prior.
Yeah.
But this must have been, because this is such a, using stock footage and back and forth and finding all the little places to put this all in. It must have been kind of hellish to integrate this all.
It was a nightmare. I remember this moment we're looking at right now. I remember you on set looking at the footage of this and you realized, it hadn't occurred to me, that you had to match the lipstick that you were wearing. And it was you and the makeup person looking at it going, so is it sort of orangey?
looking at the footage, right?
Yes.
But I actually pointed out the scene when I was going through with my notes. I think it was edited very well because 5 years, you changed quite a bit. And there's also, I had a wig. And so the original footage, I had the, so it's one thing if you do the scenes where they're new scenes, but the scenes where you're trying to add in footage of an existing from 5 years ago with a wig to a non-wig. And it just didn't, I don't think it would cut very well. And in that particular scene, you never see my face with new footage.
Yes, you're right. I think we see the handoff. We see,
You hear me, you see the back of my head, but you don't actually see me face to face.
Oh,
to the new footage.
Well, then screw the lipstick. It doesn't matter.
We shot it and maybe we just didn't edit it, or maybe there's a glimpse or a profile something, but it did seem like it was very well edited to kind of hide the differences of 5 years.
Oh,
and I'm not just talking wrinkles, but
no, there were a lot of those scenes where we had to match it perfectly. Like what's in the background later on when we see Boomer when she's dripping wet in the scene that we pulled from water. And you have to see, okay, what's behind her on the shelves? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, what have we got that's roughly that shape? You know, it was panic inducing because I was up there in Vancouver on my own producing it. Ron wasn't there. And so as crises would come up of like, this isn't going to match, or someone realizes that something is being referenced that hasn't happened, or just, oh, did I make a mistake in the continuity? It was a nightmare. This trying to fit this puzzle together. It was crazy.
Now, did you have a list of the sort of the questions you wanted to answer that the show had left open? Like, who is Six talking to when she says, you know, I thought it might be you or whatever that is?
Yeah, we did. That was when the staff was all still together and this was going to be Wedlin Thompson's project. We started with the big long list and we really cover a huge number of things, just little things. I mean, there were big things. What did Baltar whisper and stuff? But there were little things where you're like, there's a line about, you know, what's her name? Get away. Oh,
Shelley Godfrey.
Yes. Thank you, Shelley Godfrey. How did she get away? Oh, we ran around the guard said they went around the corner and she was gone. It's like, oh, we can explain that. We can explain how she got away so fast. Like we tried to explain every possible thing we could, which means that this is a little confection for completists. It is much more about just like ticking that stuff off and telling like this, threading it on to loosely, like beads on a string of this little story of these two Cavils. But it is about hitting those little marks so that people can sort of check off. Oh, I see how they made the puzzle fit together.
It was interesting because we've seen Cavil so much more over the last season. You see the differences with all the Final Five and the other Cylons, and to really base this from Cavil's perspective in many ways, right?
Right.
As the kind of go-to, the point person, boss, so to speak. It was interesting to see that. But I was thinking, because both Ron and David have told us that, you know, the Cylons and their plan, that tagline, that they never knew what it was through the entire time. So it feels kind of funny that this is like, okay, well, let's make up this plan now at the very end.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do the Cylons have a plan? Well, it sounds like a good tagline. And then so let's call this the plan and tell our entire story all over again from the silent point of view. But even in this, even the joke is that it's called the plan because
they don't have one.
Yeah. In the text of it, someone even says to Cavill, like, there was never a plan. And you realize it was, this thing was sort of one man, two man's petty personal quest the entire time. This is as personal, as human an endeavor, this whole Holocaust, as anything could be. It was never a grand robotic plan. It was just the human soul inside these fleshy robots that made this whole thing happen.
What was the mission brief at the beginning? You know, what, when Ron, you know, and David and the staff got together, what was the, like, we want to tell X, you know, the top line version of what this was going to be.
This was the whole series again, from the silent point of view, and fill in all the missing gaps that you couldn't along the way when you were trying to hide everything. And also you didn't know, you know, it's certain TV to a certain extent, you don't know exactly where you're going. So you want to leave things vague so you can go back later and lay them in and reference things that happened earlier in leave your options open. Okay, it's all done. All the options have been closed off. Now we can go back and pick up any threads that were left and tie them all up. So it's meant to be, yeah, a confection for completists is as good as I can get on what it's intended to be.
It was interesting to see, like, the Cylons in the ship before, mm-hmm. or in the fleet before. Yeah. We, you know, through the series, we find them out, but to see them beforehand, yeah. is interesting. Like, oh, they were there all along. It was a Simon there. We knew there was a Doral and a,
right.
and a Leoben and, you know, and a Six. But like, oh, there's more than one Six. And there's like,
yes, exactly. Yes. We got to meet Tough Six in this one. And yeah, that they were there all along.
Is that what her name was? Tough Six?
Cause Tough Six. Yeah.
We don't actually hear her name in this, I don't think. Right.
Yeah.
I had remembered it as Hard Six, which is funnier, but I think there was some reason we couldn't do that. So she was Tough Six in the draft I was reading this morning anyway.
Uh-huh. Cause in my notes, I wrote down that she's a Dominasix.
Very nice. Oh,
that's so good. If I thought of that, I would use that.
The first time she's got the chains and the leather, I'm like, oh, this is a different flavor.
Yeah, we wanted sixes you could immediately tell weren't a six we'd met before, you know.
And how, you know, judicious, or I guess, you know, swing for the fences were you guys in the sort of recontextualizing the information the audience has? You know, because I don't think, you know, and we had just watched the whole show, but it was new to me that Cavill knew who the final five were.
Right. And those are all sort of Ron level decisions. So, you know, as we were breaking the story, as we were getting approval on outline and early drafts and stuff, that's the kind of thing where you'd go, Ron, do you think he knew? Yeah. And then you get your answer and you work around that.
And that they were all sort of expected to perish in the attacks, right?
Right.
And they had the, you know, the duplicates, so to speak, ready to go.
And then not only did they survive, they all survive. And then four of the five are all immediately in that same little fleet. And it's like, this is crazy. Yeah, everyone except Anders was, anyway.
There's one scene later on of the Cavils, I think, when they're being marched to the airlock and they just turn around and, you know, people around the fleet are coming in to kind of look at these two being sent off.
Yeah.
And they just look and there's the final five all sitting there. And it's just the look of kind of, you've got to be fucking kidding me.
Yeah.
My language, but on the Cavils' faces of like, this is not how this was supposed to go down.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a green screen stuff here. That's very nice. I'm just looking over it.
This Tori climbing out of the overturned car.
Yes. And
the destruction, destruction is just.
Yeah. It's all, I mean, Gary Hutzel.
Oh, Gary Hutzel.
Time and time again, like just a beast. Because all of this stuff, and I have to imagine, I mean, you had some money to produce this, but not like a lot of money.
No. And a lot of this was amazingly shoestringed and yet gorgeous work. So this pile of rubble was sitting there in Vancouver as they were literally bulldozing the sets as we would finish them.
Yeah, because we shot the finale right before this.
Yeah.
Right. And so they were already taking apart the sets and everything. So when I was watching some of the stuff in the CIC, that all had to be the archive footage, right? We couldn't shoot in the CIC because it had been torn apart for the destruction in the finale of Galactica falling apart finally.
Yeah, there were sets that weren't there anymore and sets that they were bulldozing. And then I think that pile of rubble was actual rubble of sets that had been taken down. This and Face of the Enemy were the two things that we shot in close succession after the production had finished. And both of them were done on with what sets we had left and what personnel we could get, and very shoestringy. But yeah, they clearly put some money into it. I never learned how to deal with the budget stuff, but it looks beautiful.
Jane, what is it like joining a show as late as you joined Battlestar? You know, because I think that, you know, not to say that most TV experiences are one way or another, but coming in on the fourth season of a show, you know, what does that feel like? Both as that writer and then the atmosphere of the room and then some sense of catch up, like, are you disoriented or is it cool?
The shows I had been on to that point were Dinosaurs, a show called Monty, Me and the Boys, Something So Right, Ellen, Buffy, Gilmore Girls. And almost all of them, I was either brought in the last season or there was only one season. Buffy was sort of the rare exception. So I was used to that. I came in Dinosaurs. The show had already been canceled when I was put on that staff. So I was just there for the end.
So you're the closer, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, am I the reason all these shows are going away? So for a very long time until Buffy, I was not on a show that lasted a year beyond my being hired. So I was used to that. You step into a culture and you step into a show you're already a fan of. And that's the upside. Like the downside is you've got to figure out the culture and how you can contribute. The upside is that you're a fan. So you're getting to walk around into the screen, into a show where these people, the characters are already real to you by the time you meet the actors. And I think that's wonderful because then you really get, when I walked around these sets, it was really like I was walking around inside the TV set. It was wonderful. Upside, downside, but there's something nice about seeing the completion of a show, everything nicely tied up. At the end of Dinosaurs, very much like this show, we sort of, the Ice Age came in and all the dinosaurs faced the fact that they were about to go extinct. It was a moving experience to be there for the ending of that. It was sort of, it started where Battlestar started.
True.
There was that shot we just passed by. We have not been doing a very good job of being scene specific because we haven't talked at all about what's on screen besides that's rubble.
Right.
But there was that shot of Bill Adama in his quarters reading the note. There are only 12 cell line models. Right. Was that not one of the questions you wanted to answer, which is who left him that note?
Right. Did we not answer that? I'll put it on the list. Oh, it's too late.
I remember talking to Ron about it. I guess it was like the finale of season one. And he was just talking about the kind of ramshackle nature of the miniseries. Right. And he was like, yeah, there's some stuff that we just didn't even just whatever. That was cool. That's a tease. That's tantalizing. Maybe we'll figure it out later. It's like, and we never did.
Yeah, that one we didn't get to. That was probably discussed, and there's just not an easy way to do it, or we didn't know, or something.
I kind of like still leaving it in. You know, it's like you know what? There's still questions we're not gonna answer for you.
That might have been the conscious decision, actually, because that sounds like Ron of like why not leave something? and there were things like like Colonel Ty, Mrs. Ty here. Why am I blanking on her name?
Ellen.
Thank you, Ellen. She said that she was rescued by a mysterious stranger, and it always sounded so dicey. No, she was sleeping with some guy, and she didn't want to say, no, it was a mysterious stranger. He even introduces himself as, hey, I'm a mysterious stranger. I love
in the bar.
Yeah, in the bar.
And you see, it's like, because Cavill's always been a little bit more on the sadistic side. Mm-hmm. Not sadistic, but he's bitter. And the fact that he just lets her, and even says it in this scene where he's by her bedside after she's been definitely hurt in the attacks, and he lets her suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he purposely helps her, I think, survive to suffer.
Yeah. Cavill is a piece of work. The two Cavills in this, by the way, in the script are called F. Cavill and C. Cavill. So Fleet Cavill and Caprica Cavill.
I did like seeing how the Resistance and Anders, because when we originally meet them, they're already pretty strong opponents, right? They've got their kind of base, not base, but their team down. And it was nice to see how they kind of developed into the Resistance.
You know, I'd sort of forgotten, like, wait, they're all like a basketball team, sort of. That's weird. So we got to see them play pyramid and then, like, oh, your planet blows up and you realize, oh, we're off at training camp. Maybe we're maybe there aren't that many survivors and we're it. Like, okay, what are we going to do? This was all really fun, imagining all the stuff that's been sort of referenced, but never really engaged with. And you go, okay, well, let's engage with, what does this team do?
Yeah. I like the red dawn of it. You know, they're like, here we are. We're just a bunch of guys and the Russians are here.
Yeah.
Wolverines.
And by the way, he was just holding up a part of a metal Cylon. And that was a thing that blew my mind when I started working on the show. I kept referencing Cylon parts and they kept having to tell me there are no Cylon parts because the Cylons are entirely CG, the metal Cylons. So you can't have a part. And I finally got parts. I finally was like, why can't you just make something metal that looks like it's part of a robot?
You're going to make me a Cylon limb, okay? A Centurion limb.
Yes, Centurion. Yes, and I finally got it.
Did you keep it? Did you steal it from the set?
No, I don't have any of that. I didn't get any. I have a copy of Sea Rider Falcon, which is the book that Adama reads to Laura as she's dying. So I have that. That was my keep.
Now Mark has a whole angle on this.
I mean, we asked Ron about it because I've been in love with Sea Rider Falcon, even though I don't know what the book is about. and so when we had him on for the penultimate episode, I was like, tell me that somewhere you've written all of Sea Rider Falcon. And he was like, no, that's a Jane thing. that's not a me thing. The question is, do you have all of Sea Rider Falcon written somewhere?
No, I wrote a big chunk. I mean, a page worth, enough for the prop guys to make the prop. But I have a copy of the book, which, of course, you know, they take an existing book, they cut the corners off it, and they paste in the one page. But it's an actual book of some obscure old book.
Wow!
I love this. Do you know about the plan? That's the only plan there ever was. The whole notion that they have a plan sort of comes from this flyer.
That Cicinus. Cicinus was putting up for Cavill. Yeah.
Right.
The flyer that he was posting all over the
yes,
world.
Exactly. And then we realized, it was for Cavill to assemble the Cylons on board the ship. And there's Tough Six.
Tough Six.
Dominate
so
Six.
Great. Looking so good.
Chewing gum. The dichotomy between the Shelley Godfrey, who was all very like prim and proper, and then Tough Six was fun to play.
So much fun. You're so good here. This is so fun.
Oh, how many edges on the flyer weren't cut off? I kept on wondering. I'm like,
I thought all paper was. It probably should have been.
Oh.
That's probably an error.
Oh, Tough Six. Tough Six is now my new favorite six.
Oh, she's the best.
It feels like she's an extra from like Happy Days. Just chewing her gum.
No, she's awesome. Yeah, it was so fun realizing that you guys could inhabit different versions of yourself. And you didn't need that much difference between the two to be able to tell them apart. You guys were all so good at becoming different people. I love it. I guess that's, I just described acting, but it's still.
And I think that moment with all of the Cylons together to hear about the plan, have you heard the good news about the plan?
Yeah.
Is the first time I think that in the episode you or the movie, you realize that the plan didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, the initial plan of, oh, we were just going to kill everybody. And, yeah. Oh, wait, hold on. Wait, what?
Well, the Cavill even says, right, something about they were supposed to, all of them were supposed to die. Yeah. We weren't supposed to be left with any of these cockroaches.
Yeah. Yeah.
The plan is everything blows up a week ago. All the humans are dead and we Cylons all download and the universe basks in justice.
That's right. That's
but
right.
It didn't work.
It didn't work. So now they just got to deal with stuff.
Yeah.
And the Cylons keep failing. Everyone keeps failing Cavill.
Yes.
Doral
yes.
doesn't manage to blow yep. many people up. Mm-hmm. Simon, you know, sacrifices himself. Yeah. Yep. He's got a wife. And yep. the sixes, you know, have a weakness for Baltar.
Yeah.
He's just like, ah.
Yes. Yeah, and it's love. It's just love over and over keeps defeating him.
Tough Six has a line to him in when they're drinking.
Yes.
Says you can't put a war on love.
Yeah, that's right. That scene is the one that really sums it up. I'm so glad that scene exists because this can be hard to follow if you are not an aficionado of the show or if it's been a few years. And that scene really helped me sort out, oh, I see what I was doing.
There is a lightness to the episode that I think is a little bit different tone than the show. I mean, it's obviously you're talking about genocide and everything. It's not like it's light, but it was that on purpose because it's from the Cylon kind of perspective that it had a slight different tone to it.
We could say that, or we could just say it's me because I like to think I'm a chameleon and yet I'm told over and over again, oh no, I heard the first pun and I knew it was your episode. Oh, okay. So I think there's just, I can't resist a joke. And you know, this episode, this, because this had such an odd reason to exist, and the story had to be like a skier on a slalom course where you just keep veering over here to hit this point. Trying to make the story compelling at every possible moment. It's a hard task. Whereas you put some humor in there and it leavens it. It keeps you going. It keeps you engaged. I'm a big believer in humor. And I think it's more realistic. Real life is hilarious. People are funny all the time, often particularly in tragedy. So I really like it when there is humor in this. I really wanted this to be just a head and an arm and just one little cable between them, so that you would not have any expectation that arm would be able to fire.
We're talking about the episode, right. The scene where the resistance is attempting to blow up the truck full of Centurion parts.
Yeah.
The first big operation of Sam and his pyramid gang, which I've now decided is also like either an Old West group of rebels or a punk band.
Yeah. But yeah, one of the Centurion is half destroyed, but still manages to pick up a gun and shoot. And it really, I wanted it to look so much more destroyed. But
I think that also the fact that this is from the perspective in great part of the Cavills and Dean Stockwell, they're funny. You know, like his angle on all of this is this weird, like blithe kind of like annoyance.
Yeah, you mentioned genocide. He actually has a line in here somewhere about, all right, let's get this genocide started. And it's like, oh, this is dark humor, but it's Cavill's humor. He has no conscience. He can take this as a joke. And I like characters like that because they can use humor without undercutting the tension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like he has this line that's about to come up where, you know, we got to give you something else to wear. They call this a suicide vest, but I think that undersells all the homicide that goes along with it.
Yeah, I love that.
I read that this morning and I was like, oh, Espenson, you still got it.
You still got the E.
I was very pleased. Yeah, there's the line. And I've like, if I hadn't used the line in this movie, I feel like I would have found somewhere else to put it because I love that joke. It's really true. There's a whole lot of homicide involved.
Suicide is actually the least of the things that it does.
That's right. That's right.
It's funny watching this on the heels of the sort of second half of the fourth season, where our entire experience of Michael Trucco is like bald and in a bathtub and like not saying very much. Mm-hmm. And to get this like one last look at him as the big damn hero that he actually is, it's like, oh, this is nice. Remember? Yeah.
And you do sort of get the like, oh, right. You know, he had a whole story worth of being the hero, being the leader of this group, becoming a leader of a group. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, we sort of had to find these little arcs to play. And his arc is a large one in this.
Yeah, I remember talking to when we had Jamie Bamber on. He said something about how he was nervous when they were casting Trucco because he thought it was like, you're going to bring another attractive, you know, black-haired, brown-haired guy on to like be Katie's love interest. Like, what are you doing to what's happening to Apollo? Where do I get to go?
Right.
It's like, oh no, he's just Sam. Sam and the Pyramid Gang.
That's right. By the way, we just heard Leoben listening to Kara Thrace over a sort of a radio, but we realized he couldn't be listening to her live, because her character was in sick bay with a messed up knee at this point. Like, there was a reason that her character, we knew where we were in the timeline precisely enough to know that she wasn't out flying missions during that scene. So we had to be listening to an old recording of her. So it was that kind of thing that just drove you crazy, because you'd have this realization of like, oh no, the timelines aren't lining up. It would
be mind numbing to keep it all straight, I think.
Yeah.
But then we introduced Gianna.
Yes, played by.
What was the idea to introduce, Lamari?
Yes, this is Eddie's wife, who is fantastic.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, this is Eddie's wife.
Ex-wife, but...
Oh,
now.
I haven't been keeping up, I guess. She was his wife at the time. She was Gianna here. And this is sort of like... A friendship. They kiss at one point, like just grazingly, and it is so clearly not a romance, just like two people going through some stuff. and I thought this was a lovely little relationship of two people who are dealing with the fact that they've just found out that they're with Cylons.
Yes, and who died in unfortunate, violent circumstances.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pain, but also the just disbelief and feeling betrayed.
Yeah,
losing the love as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but and I also appreciated that you meet Gianna right after the scene where Cavill meets that little boy who's like sleeping in the chapel or the Cylon clubhouse, and it's like these kind of two parallel stories of connection.
Right.
You know, where like Will Cavill actually, you know, do the thing that a human being does, which is see a boy who's desperately in need and help him.
Right.
Or will he stick to his guns that humanity or cockroaches meant to be squashed underfoot? And then these two, at least at this point, we thought they were humans, but turns out that they're not. But two people who are having relationships with Cylons who are unbeknownst to them, and what happens on the other side of that. And how they connect with each other and how they, you know, live with the connection they'd had before.
Yeah. And then we get to see the elephant that was established in the run of the series. We get to see how it was used to send this message between the Cylons.
Yeah. Was this also a Ron level decision about deciding to make Boomer like active and non-active based on the presence of an elephant?
I don't remember. Probably. Because you said to sort of explain, okay, how much did she know when? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was interesting to see her because I would have never, you know, watching the series or reading the series, whatever, I would have never believed and thought that she was activated as a Cylon that often, right?
Right. Yes.
Or to the degree where she, when she did go under, you know, as a human, yeah, I guess, but she doesn't understand. Like when she's under, she's a human, right. she's not understanding that she's a Cylon, but it was like, it was interesting to see her as a Cylon so much in this.
Yes. And that's fulfilling sort of one of the things you want to do in a project like this is there have to be some surprises. It can't just be, okay, we're going to show you how it all works and it's all going to make sense and you're going to understand what the Cylons were doing. There has to be a bit of like, and here's the thing you didn't know that was going on the whole time. Because this is the thing we didn't know. We didn't know she was this active. We made this up. Of like, let's say, what could she have been active throughout this? And you realize, oh, that makes sense. It makes sense. And it gives us a way to say, like, here's the thing that was happening that none of us knew about, that makes sense of all the events and gives you a surprise.
Yeah. I mean, it's a risky decision. I think it pays off. But I remember as I was watching it, because I hadn't seen it since it first aired. So watching it and like typing my notes as I'm going, I'm like, I don't know about this call. Like, I kind of feel as if like it was more resonant that she didn't know what she was doing. It's more tragic that she didn't know what she was doing.
Well, you get both.
You get both.
Yeah. You can watch the original run of the series and believe as we did at that time, that she was experiencing this sort of as we viewers are, and then you can watch this and go, or
right, yeah. But it's still tragic, but the tragedy now comes in a different place,
right?
Well, yeah. It's interesting because like with Boomer, who didn't really know when she was under, right? And she says here that she likes her life better when she's under, and that's her struggle as she's going forward. But is it sort of like all the eights would feel that, so that when you see Sharon, and Sharon was cognizant as a Cylon when we meet her down on with Tomo down on Caprica, right? Mm-hmm. And she's playing a game to get him. And then so she falls in love with him, but she comes at it from a different angle as Boomer, right? But she also she also discovers she likes her life better as a human, but she's never not known she was a Cylon.
Right.
But she chooses being a human, whereas Boomer doesn't really have the choice because of what Cavill's making her do and everything. And then she ultimately gets killed, resurrects, but then she's, throughout the rest of the series, she's up and down, right? And she's choosing the Cylon side, but not happy with her life.
Right, yeah. And yeah, I love that you get to play all the different possible paths that a person can take through the story.
And then like deathly afraid of elephants going forward.
Well, it's a good thing didn't make it down to the planet, because they're sure shooting some elephants down there. That she...
Now here's where we're going to go. This is Dripping Witch 8. And we have to try to match the room that she's in, because we're about to go into old footage. Like, we have to match this wet girl and everything in the room.
Not easy.
I couldn't believe we got away with as much as we did.
I mean, I can only imagine kind of the murder board you had up on a giant wall of like real footage, you know, new footage, this footage we can slice into this and match shots and oh man.
And now we're in the old footage. And that's the old original shot. Amazing. I can't believe it. I never do production. Like, I've always just been, I won't even be on set. I'll be in the office. I'll just be writing. And I love this. See, this is the thing about the surprise, is you assume that she like climbed out of the tank, made her way here, and then had this moment, and to realize she had a whole scene before that. Mm. I love that. I love that surprise.
Yeah. I think it's probably the most effective with Sharon. mm-hmm. you know, that sense of recontextualizing stuff that you'd already seen and just dropping a new scene in here and there to help goose that ahead.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the Cavill stuff, I mean, I guess a little bit of the Sam stuff, but I think it's most emotional with Sharon.
Yeah. Because we know and we love her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I even still, like, you know, when we had Grace on, we talked about the fact that she's an astonishingly gifted actress for somebody who'd never really done this before.
Yeah.
You know, and then to carry all of this weight, you know, of, all right, I got to play three different versions of myself, and I got to carry this whole suspense and duplicitousness and love and all of this. And like, it's this cast always blows my mind because everybody is so up to the game.
There was a thing where we were in a production meeting and someone asked me, like, do you want a different makeup treatment on Grace to show that she's a different one? And I was like, oh, yeah, maybe. And they're like, well, you can't because we don't have time to do that. and I said, oh, no. And they said, well, it actually doesn't matter because she'll do it with her face. You'll just know she's someone else. Wow. Okay.
Do you want this cool thing? Yes, yeah. Can't have it. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. this pile of bodies on Caprica was Eddie's favorite thing. That he found out that there was a sort of flammable gelatin that you could put on a stuntman so they could be on fire, and you wouldn't have to immediately put them out. The fire could just burn on their skin. And so they could be continuing to like act and move as they're on fire. So he really fell in love with this notion of that we could do this fire pit where you would see actually writhing stuntmen in the flames. this was a long, cold, dark night.
the subject matter is so hard to watch.
Yes.
But then to hear that Eddie was probably like giddy like a schoolboy about the
stunts. Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Oh.
How you have to separate sometimes, right, when you're filming because you're looking at something that just looks horrendous.
I know. And Eddie really loved pain and darkness. And he was like, life is pain and hard. As bright a light as Eddie is, there was something he loved about trying to capture genuine darkness on film. So he loved it. Like I wrote a line for him that referenced like going off to the bathroom to take a crap. And it was like his favorite thing because he was like, people do, it's real. But he loved that.
I assume in that scene, there were a lot of dummies as well as mixed in with stunt actors with fire on them and everything. Just a funny little side story. Cause when I saw that, about a year ago or 2 years ago, I think I shot Creepshow with Greg Nicotero, right? Who's this amazing makeup artist, prosthetics and everything. And my character gets decapitated. And so I had to do the whole mask, have a, you know, the fake head made. And he loves to tell me that they're going to use my head. And it felt very, I felt very possessive over my head.
Sure.
But apparently like what there's like the prosthetic houses that have made all these, they have just oodles of dummies, but also like he said they used a Brad Pitt one in one scene in like The Walking Dead, because they just had the production or the prosthetic house had a Brad Pitt head. A cast of his head. So there's like Brad Pitt in a scene. And I'm like, how many times are you going to use my head in a scene? He's like, oh, just you wait. And I felt very like possessive over it. Like, you can't use my head.
It's your image. Yeah, you actually probably had to sign that away at some point.
I wonder how Shatner feels about his face being the model for the Mike Myers mask.
Oh, right.
You know, because that's just a Shatner mask that's kind of like left out in the sun and painted a little bit. It's like, oh, that's my face on that homicidal maniac.
The life of an actor, the things you guys put up with. It's amazing.
Was this your first time? And forgive me, I didn't grind through the credits to see if there were more, but working with Eddie as a director, what is that experience like? You know, aside from his, you know, apparent love for darkness and the reality of life, but you know, how do you find him as a director compared to him being an actor?
I loved working with Eddie. He was kind of tough on me. This was not the first thing he directed of mine. He directed an episode I wrote. And he was kind of tough on me, I felt like, at the first table read. And I sort of stood up to him a little bit, and then we were cool. working with him on this was kind of exhausting but satisfying. We would work on the script most evenings after shooting. And I hate being on set. Those hours are so long, and it's so cold, and you'd be so exhausted. But he'd want to go over the next day's stuff, and it would be, I think he already had his shots and all planned, but we would go through the script, and he would trim dialogue out. But because Eddie's dyslexic, he has to read it all out loud to hear it. He can't sort of just scan it on the page. So it's sort of a long process of him reading all the dialogue and all the scenes that were going to be shot and crossing out the bits that he felt we didn't need. So it was very painstaking, but the attention to detail, the awareness of what you need to say and what you actually don't need to say. I really enjoyed working with Eddie a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I have to imagine that he gets more latitude than your average director coming in to shoot a Battlestar.
Oh,
yes. And then it's like, yeah, buddy, I'm sorry. Yeoman dude is doing this for one, you know, week and then moving on. You're not cutting these lines of dialogue.
Well, you know, if Ron had written the script, Ron could have pushed back. I was not going to push back against it at all. And there was no one above me on the set. I mean, I was producing it. So Eddie very much had loads and loads of authority. I was not going to try to take it away. He'd been there a lot longer than I was, and he's the admiral. He really is.
We also, with this one, I don't know why it wasn't that way when we did Razor, but with The Plan, maybe there had been an overseas sale or something, but we had purposely to show more nudity.
Right.
Then, you know, we didn't show nudity in the series, and in Razor, you'd see flesh, of course, but I remember specifically, and I think it was for like an overseas sale, that like we actually had to get some boobs in there.
That's interesting. I don't remember that we had to, but I remember that we were going to. And well,
there's a scene at the strip club early on when Ellen Ty meets the mysterious stranger, and there's a topless bartender in the sort of background. I was like, wait a minute, is that a whole timeout?
And when we see in the head,
we
see quite a bit of nudity in the head.
Yeah. And that was Eddie. I love Eddie for this, because I had been advocating for years, like, we shouldn't just be seeing naked women. We should see naked men too. Let's get some equality on this. And Eddie was right there with me. So we had signed up an equal number of male and female extras who were willing to be naked. But then, as often happens, all the males at the last minute got scared and said, no, I'm not going to take my trousers off. Except we had one. So we had, you know, boobs, and one penis. And Eddie was like, well, we're going to have to get that one on film, because I insist that we have a penis in this, because it's not fair if we don't. So I have this distinct memory of Eddie running after the Steadicam guy yelling, shoot the cock.
I'm glad you said that, because I've told this story, right, Mark? I've told the story before, where this scene where Cavill and Six walk through the head.
Yeah.
And it took a long time. And I remember Dean Stockwell going, what is going on? Why are we redoing this? Why are we doing this again and again and again and again? Because we're waiting in a corridor on the other side, right, to come through the door. And I've told this story where I specifically remember Eddie finally, after like the 20th take or whatever, just yelling. And it was right after Dean Stockwell goes, what is taking so long? Why are we redoing it? And then you hear Eddie yelling from Video Village, I need to see the dick. So that's exactly what you're saying. Yes. We just heard ring through the corridors, I need to see the dick, in the admiral's voice. And then Dean just looks at me and he's like, I've never in my 60 some years of working in this business. Like,
Quantum Leap sure wasn't like this.
Oh, well, it made my little equality loving heart so happy, because I've just always felt that's just so unfair. that the male gaze is employed so consistently. And I felt like we made some progress there. That one poor extra who was regretting the whole time that he hadn't chickened out like the others.
Yeah.
And there's the Admiral. Oh my God. I'm sure he was very self-conscious. Oh, and I love that we stay on your side of this. Mm. We saw his side and it's so funny on his side, and on your side, it's so sad. I love this. This is one of my favorite things.
Stupid
hair.
Stupid hair.
Oh, Walter. He's dreamy.
The more I watched, you know, this, especially right now, on the heels of watching The Vow and being sort of back in the whole like Nexium business.
Yes.
I'm like, Cavill and Keith Raniere are very much utilizing the same kind of tools. Like that sense of like intimacy plus sort of revulsion plus, you know, negging plus, you know, gentle, like all of it is very cult leader.
And with some of the same people. I've tried not to know too much, but I agree. Cavill is a very cult leader kind of guy. He uses all the psychological tools.
Yeah. Like now even more so than Baltar.
I have to interrupt there for a second. There wasn't actually any correlation because I had somebody on Twitter yesterday accusing like the show of being involved in Nexium.
And oh no, no.
Reading all these people. I'm like, no, he's just written like that. It has nothing to do. None of us were aware of that at the time.
No.
I had no idea and knew nothing about it until the news broke like 2 or 3 years ago, whatever. But
yeah, me too. What was going on?
Exactly. But the show had nothing to do with it at all.
None
of us were aware. So Mark, when you're saying like, he's like that, I'm like, no, no.
It's not that at all, except only a little bit. And the psychosis of the cult leader.
Right.
This is as good an explication of that as any.
That's right. And we just saw, by the way, the scene in which we saw the clever way in which she suddenly was much farther down the corridor because there were two of you.
It's the whole bait and switch. It's the prestige.
Yeah. Yes. Tough six puts on a wig. And
Yes. Yeah. Which it's so cool that you had a wig that looks exactly like your hair because your hair had been a wig. It's just, I love when stuff like that works out.
Wow. Every time we go to this like stock footage in the CIC, it's like, oh, look at all these people who aren't there anymore.
I know.
Duala and oh man, Gata.
Yeah. Early footage. I love the way it's mixed in here. It's so cool.
It's like a puzzle piece.
Yeah.
And seeing, like a puzzle, putting it all together.
Yeah. And seeing Michael Hogan, who as we're writing this, Michael Hogan is struggling a bit with a disability right now. So anyone who wants to help Michael Hogan should go look at the GoFundMe for Michael Hogan, who had a fall.
We have mentioned that. And I actually just bought a clock at the beginning of the plan. We see the clock in 33 where they've got the taped 33 on top of the face of the clock, and Fleet is family, I guess, has done with the proceeds going towards Michael Hogan's fund. And I bought one of the clocks. I'm waiting for it. I'm so excited to put it up in my kitchen. It's just the face with the 33 mark.
Oh, I love that. That's so cool.
I might have to get one of those. Even though I have no place to put a clock, I would totally get one of those. You know, and like the problem of being a relatively moderately employed television writer is suddenly you're like, I could buy that. I could even like find, is it up for auction? Like I'd buy the real one. It's a dumb, stupid use of money, except I really want it.
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's the things you really want, that's a good use of money.
That's true.
Yeah.
Oh, Shelley gets
her. Yeah.
I hate seeing, like, I don't hate seeing, but it's interesting to see the sixes. They never want to be, you know, Caprica, she chose having a broken leg over being, that's when she killed Deanna in Downloaded in the second season. And here, Shelley does not want to go out the airlock.
Right.
She's like, no, I can hide. I can disguise myself. I can hide out in the fleet. You can put me on another mission. He's like, no, Get your ass out the airlock.
Yeah, but give the coordinates back to the fleet. Let them know where we are.
The sixes always break my heart. It's your face, I think. your face more than my writing. That's just like so much humanity there. Oh my God. Six, Caprica six, always.
Yeah, was Shelley Godfrey as in love with Baltar as Caprica six was? Or was she just kind of infatuated with him and his bouncy hair?
I think infatuated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I mean, that scene of her sort of like sinking down inside the bathroom stall, it's like, oh, that is a woman who is clearly just, you know, head over heels in love with this guy.
Well, or in love with love, like wanting someone to love. So it's, and that feeling when you're in it, you can't tell the difference between those two. So maybe she couldn't either.
Mm. Yeah. And they would share some memories, right? Because I know there was in one of the episodes with the eights, one of the eights could download. It was the episode, remember, Mark, where I can't remember which one it was, but where one of the eights purposely puts her hand in the goo or whatever in that.
In the data stream
and download Sharon's memories so that she could kind of feel what it was like. And so maybe there was some of that with Shelley of sort of understanding some of Caprica's actual feelings as opposed to just sense. That's my sister or whatever. She went through this kind of thing, but actually physically feeling some of it and feeling maybe a love towards Baltar that one of the other like the fours or whatever wouldn't have.
That's a really good point. I wonder if that happened. We need another movie to explain it.
The plan too.
That's right.
Electric Boogaloo.
Oh, boy.
Cavill and this kid.
Oh. Cavill and the kid, yeah.
It's just, he's just like the little boy. You just want to help him. And
I got to be in, for someone who never does production, I was in every step of this thing. So I got to be in all the casting sessions with Eddie and auditioning little kids and then auditioning, the roles for the various pyramid players and stuff, people who hadn't already been cast. There were new characters there. And Eddie sort of, even with someone who he had already had decided he wasn't going to cast, he would spend so long with them and make them cry in a good way. He would go, if the scene, really emotional scene, your family's just been killed. I think you can do it better. Let's see you do it better. Let's really think about what you would feel like in this moment. And he just, his ability to make these people act better than they ever had in their life and burst into tears. It was amazing. I felt like I was in a masterclass. Fantastic. Wow. Yeah.
And that kid grew up to be Miles Teller. I don't know.
I wonder where that kid is now.
Yeah. That kid could be working every day. I don't know who he was.
Oh, yeah, boomer shooting the old man.
Dean Stockwell, a favorite of mine forever and ever. I can't believe I got to work with him. I can't believe we got to go work with him. I watched Quantum Leap when I was, already an aspiring writer, but I watched him in, he was a kid actor. Like, he's been doing this forever. Mm.
I think he was saying like he was at 6 years old, he was on Broadway or something.
Oh my God. Well, The Boy with Green Hair was him. And that was a early sci-fi of him as a boy.
Wow.
Oh. Yeah. It was, yeah. I loved working with him. Oh, there's my butt.
Yeah.
Like, whose butt is that? Your butt.
There's my butt. On that note, we should take a little break. We will be right back.
Back
with my butt.
Yes, the back end of that break.
Yeah, I suppose everybody else is probably past it now. So we did not take a break for our sponsors. We just took a mini break.
Yeah, we took a pause for the cause. Yeah.
And this is the scene that with which, again, we have something surprising. I had no idea this was going on our ship. But also, we get a lot of good exposition in this scene. So we find out about the extent to which the plan has really gone off the rails.
Yeah, because Six decides to list them all.
Yes.
Much to Cavill's chagrin. Because he's not enjoying having it told to listed to him, but
exactly
it is.
I was also impressed, you know, watching this. We'd spent some time with Simons over the course of the show, but I think, you know, Rick Worthy in this one is really, you know, there's a gravity to him in all of these scenes. Like he's really holding down the center of every scene that he's in and keeping it kind of focused and real. And yeah, like even though like we spent time with him on the farm and we would kind of check in with him here and there, but this is the one where I think, you know, sadly the last one, I'm like, oh, he's really good.
He's really good. I wish we'd used him more. Sometimes there's someone, you know, they're good and there's just no place. The story doesn't go there, but boy, yeah, he's really good.
It was nice to have that, like Gianna, the story with him and his wife, to get more of him and his story. It was nice to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And we just had an exchange that I really like where he says, you should have killed Adama. And she says, I shot him twice in the chest. What do you want? And he says, how about once in the head? And I love that, because that's sort of what we call hanging a lantern, where you sort of point at a thing that's, it's usually used when you sort of point at a mistake and go like, well, that's not really a mistake. We meant it. And this where you go like, oh yeah, wait, she could have, Boomer could have tried much harder to kill Adama. Oh, that's not a bug. That's a feature. We're pointing at her humanity and that she couldn't do it. Not that we just failed to have her be an effective assassin.
Right. And then Chief Tyrell gets to underline it later when he says like, she was an expert marksman.
Yeah.
Like
she
doesn't miss. You know, maybe these Cylons like get up to the edge of doing a bad thing, and their humanity is what keeps them from being, you know, completely awful.
Right.
And Sharon says, not Sharon, Boomer says in later when she's talking to Cavill, or maybe it was there in that scene, she was saying, in order to get this done, to shoot him, I became like, I think she says centurion. The centurion. Yeah, she felt the bullet going through her, you know, hard metal arms and everything. But obviously, clearly not enough to shoot him in the head.
Like, right. That's right.
Oh. Yeah. Back down. And I like this, you know, the ongoing evolution of Caprica at Cavill. You know, like, and Simon is pointing it out. It's like, dude, what are we doing here?
Right.
Like, you know, what's 2 months after and these guys are not dead yet and you're helping the resistance? Why?
Right.
You know, what is this about? You know, and it's, and is it that he's softening? Is it his relationship with Sam that's beginning to build?
I mean, he considers Sam one of his dads and he wants approval from dad. And he sort of says at the end of it, you know, like we just wanted to be loved by our parents. So, oh, it's so sad. And I like the way, even though it would have been lovely to have Katie in this, the way we check in with Starbuck in the background, it's interesting to see that notion that, you know, everyone's a hero in their own story, and in real life there's no secondary characters, and I like just going off with the character and moving our star sort of to the background for a while and realizing like, oh, in somebody else's story, they're the extra.
And the post production on it, like it's able to take things that you know and then you remember, you recognize, and just shift a perspective on it. It's like, oh, yeah, I remember that conversation. I remember all this gunfire. I remember this big Mexican standoff that goes on in the middle of the woods there. But this scene is not about that.
Right. The scene is not about that. Yeah.
But we're not letting you forget that either.
Right. And that was another thing to do is, like, in the script, you could indicate what episode we have caught up to, but you've got to find things on the screen to help the audience know where we are in the timeline. It was just such a big puzzle. I think I would not advise anyone who is looking for a way into Battlestar Galactica to start here.
You can imagine people rewatching after watching the plan.
Right.
To go, oh, that's where this, but not, don't start with it.
Don't start here. It's not going to make a lick of sense. This really is, after we watched the screening of this, we were already in production on Caprica, and we watched this, Eddie had put together a cut of this, and we went and watched it. And we were like, okay, that is not a satisfying standalone experience. It does. It's beautiful for, someone who really loves the show. But I don't think it was ever meant to stand on its own as, like, this is a movie you could sit down without knowing anything. Like, right. No, this is a companion piece.
Yes.
Television, when men and women can climax simultaneously.
Yeah. It was Eddie directing his own wife.
That is so weird.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine.
He was in his element. He was just loving it. Like, I want more skin here, more sweat there. Oh, the sweat. He wanted so much sweat on them. Yeah.
It's probably the most awkward for Rick.
Oh, probably. You're right. In the scene. You're right. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, I remember Carrie's face when we were watching Unfinished Business, as it's Jamie just kissing every woman on the show. And she's like, oh, it's another scene where Jamie's kissing somebody. There we go.
I'm like, sorry, Carrie, you weren't supposed to be here while we were taping this.
You crashed this party.
And this is the actual moment. This is a, you know, probably the sort of same scene as we were in before, but this is the actual bit where you explain it all.
Yeah.
But not very accurately, since she loved him. So great.
Yeah.
This is awesome. Doral blew himself up, causing minor damage to a minor hallway.
It's so true. And there's a little bit where I, like, we're not too precious with our show, where we can say, like, remember that big moment where Doral blew himself up? Yeah, think about what did the Cylons accomplish?
Actually hurt themselves because they picked him out as a Cylon. Like, it started the humans down the track of, like, knowing there was multiple humanoid looking, human looking Cylons. It actually hurt them.
Cavill is not very good at this.
I know. They're like the Keystone Cops the entire time. It's like, oh, you're the master strategist? This was you?
Yeah.
You're not Lex Luthor, pal. You're like the intern.
Yeah. And this is the thing about love. Why are they letting you down? What's the X factor? And we know it's love.
You can't declare war on love. Yeah.
I think he says, I think I already did. Yeah. And I thought the line was, I thought I already did. I don't know. Stuff gets changed.
On the day.
Yeah.
Special footage.
Yeah. Not stock footage,
but previously seen footage, I think. And we had to match that location. If I recall, like, that had been torn down or was something where, if, like, finding the thing that looked like that shot was a big deal, if I recall.
Where they did the farm, that building and everything?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Rebel base.
Wow.
Yeah.
And even the room that the Cavill and Simon are in, there's a lot of, like, all right, we just got to find some olive drab boxes to stack. That'll sell that it's the same location.
A lot of cheating of locations and stuff. And I like that, again, it's a scene we know well, and then you reveal there's someone on the other side of a wall. listening to it. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a bad shot.
And this is Cavill jealous because dad's got a girlfriend.
And human one.
Genuinely human one. And so the whole plan to like go take her ovaries and stuff is all this. He's so jealous. What are they doing?
And saying things like her tiny brain, like he just seems like a petulant little child.
Yes, he really is.
He loves her vigorously. She's beneath him, not necessarily.
Would you quit making jokes?
I love some humor.
Okay.
When his heart is breaking, you put the humor in there. And again, I swear it does not undercut the tension. Every textbook will tell you humor undercuts the tension, and it does not have to. It can heighten it, because you know with every joke that Cavill is getting angrier and angrier, and the stakes are going up for Kara as he gets more and more jealous. Like the jokes make it worse.
Did we know before the plan that the Cavills were the number one model? I don't remember that.
I thought we did.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, did we knew. Yeah. Because Ellen says, I made you first.
Right.
I think in one of the scenes where, when Ellen first comes back,
mm-hmm.
when she's resurrected and she's on the base ship, there was that one episode that had a lot of exposition in the way of the two of them talking and really getting a lot of information out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was in that one.
That sounds right.
Not exposition in a bad way, but I remember, Mark, we talked about it. Like, they get a lot of information out, just the two of them talking. And I think it's in that. That's when she talks about Daniel and that mm-hmm. his entire line was boxed and mm-hmm. things like that. And
right.
he was the artsy one.
I remember that she said that we made you first, but I didn't realize that the numbers of the Cylons were the order off the product line.
Yeah, I think it's production number. Yeah.
Wow. The Model T, buddy.
Yeah, he has a line at some point in this about you gave him that body and I got this. Like I'm the number one son. Like, I should have been given the best of everything. He's just so petty the whole time. Yes. And you know, that's what Ron really liked in the concept of Caprica. That in telling the backstory of the creation of the first Centurion, it starts with an angry teenager. Alessandra Torresani character in Caprica was an angry teenager and thus became the Cylon race. And it kind of does make sense. There is a certain petulance.
Mm-hmm. I love this scene between these two guys. Like, it's by the time you get, you get two actors like this and we've lived with them for as long as we have, and to just be able to sit down and talk about failures and talk about like self-perspective and, you know, Sam just saying like, listen, I was a coward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to run. I almost did, except somebody would have seen me and I didn't want to be embarrassed. Mm-hmm. And it's just so human. And it's like, it's what would happen with somebody who was not trained for this in the middle of this, who all he has is his team and he doesn't want to let his team down. But it's just gorgeous stuff. And then for Cavill to be moved by that admission, to be able to ask Dad, it's mm-hmm. like, can you ever forgive me?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no. Are you out of your minds? You destroyed 1 billion souls.
He's, and Cavill, from Cavill's point of view, like, I just absolved you. Can't you forgive me? Like, I forgave you. Can't you forgive me? And mm-hmm. and to have that taken away from him. Yeah, I like this. I like this. I when I look back at this movie, because it doesn't stand on its own, because it is a companion piece, sometimes I feel like, oh, should it have been better? Is there something I could have done? I'm not really a producer. I'm a writer. But I had to produce it. And I often feel like maybe it isn't what it should be. But you watching it now with you guys, there's some stuff. There's some good stuff. There are things that I'm seeing that I'm enjoying. So thank you for making me go back and look at this. I really mean that.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely moments in this that excavate things in these characters that hadn't been excavated before.
Yeah.
You know, and finding ways, especially after 70 some odd hours of television, to find new things to say mm-hmm. about these characters after their stories have reached their, you know, according to Hoyle, conclusion.
Right.
It's a bit of a magic trick. you know.
Yes.
And so yeah, well done.
Good on you. Thank you. I'm making my peace with it, and so that's nice. This was Chief here really wanted to lose like 40 pounds. So he was like, I'm going to come in. You won't recognize, you'll be able to tell when it's me after these events, like the shooting order gave him time. He didn't lose any weight, so, which is probably better because it might've been a nightmare.
Yeah. He doesn't look that far off though. I mean, there's, and maybe it's because you minimize a lot of the early Chief early on. But like, he's not like 1,000 miles away from what he was in the miniseries.
No, it wasn't that he wanted to like get back to where he was. It was that he wanted to get gaunt. He wanted us, and that is
that wouldn't have matched either, right?
Right. Yeah. No, that would have. I think that would have been probably really hard to work with.
No. She knows who Simon is.
She knows who Simon is because of a picture of the pyramid team and the team doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that feeling, what you could compare that feeling to in our world.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's finding out they had a different life, another family, and all those people who find out, oh, their husband has another wife and kid somewhere else.
Duplicitous.
I knew a writer whose grandpa had, they discovered when he died that there was another wife and family out there somewhere.
Right. Or like discovering that your grandfather was like Himmler or something.
It's right.
Like,
yeah.
So granddad was a Nazi.
Right.
Oh, that's not good. In every way.
Exactly. Yeah. And, she says a thing here about she imagines herself swan diving off the top. And that's thing I think we had already established him having that image. Yes.
That's the dream, the nightmare he keeps having or the dream he keeps having. Yeah. And of doing that. And that's, to see that this is where it kind of was implanted into his conscience.
I was always looking for those things. What's a thing we could learn in this scene where we could learn something that explains a thing? So that was like, I wanted to go beyond the loose ends. Like nobody, you don't think of that image as a loose end, but you see it strike him there. Yeah.
I mean, one of the threads for a plot line like this, does it appear to you as the finale of it, knowing where you have to get to? Or was it, let's launch this story and see where it ends and see if we can end it in a place that harmonizes with the original footage? You know, like the desire to have, you know, to see the origin of that image of him swan diving off a thing, or to give him somebody to commiserate with about being in love with a Cylon, you know, and then backtracking it into, all right.
You know? I think the image was a grace note, but the commiserating was the point of it. So I think one of those was primary and one was secondary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There he is.
And he's grappling with the, what if you're a Cylon and don't know it? I love that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he kisses her.
Yeah.
And it's like that was not supposed to be a thing.
a very sweet little kiss. I like the way they played it because it's indicated in the script that this is not passion. It's not going somewhere. It is it is just two people who are like, oh, I know exactly what pain you're in.
Yeah, it's a connection.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Just like a, I can't even think of the word of it, but it's not, I want to jump your bones right now.
Right.
It's just, you understand.
Yes, exactly. Scrappy.
Yeah.
Words like that.
You know, and I also think that maybe it's, you know, Cavill for the first time is proud of somebody that's not him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sense of like, hey, man, you built a thing here. You did a good job, kid. Like, I didn't think it was possible, but you, of all these people...
Well, and here's where he's just been told that like the final five's love for humanity is going to last beyond their death, and that that it's not just Kara he's competing with. He's competing with this love of humanity that he's never going to be in the number one son where he's the only one who's loved. Mm. I mean, I think he's got some older child syndrome going on of like, I was the first model. There was a time when I was the only loved one, and now it's come to this.
It's right. Not only the other Cylon models, it's all of humanity.
It's not just the other Cylon, and it's not just Kara. It's all of humanity.
Yeah. It's very much Lucifer, right? Where it's, you know, I was the first among the heavenly host and I was the most loved among all, but then suddenly there's these people and you're going to love them more than you love me, and you're going to give them free will and not me. And it's time to rebel. I will be the first among the fallen.
That's right. I love this. And this is a little thing where you think, I see the Cylon on the ground is getting more and more bitter, and the Cylon in the fleet, like, he's actually being a good guy, and his evolution is going to be toward loving humanity, and he's not going to be able to hurt that little boy. He's giving him his apple, but it doesn't work out that way.
No.
Asks his name and everything, and then he asks him, and John, right? And wasn't that his name?
Yeah, John Gale. That was his name. Yeah, so that's like in his mind, that's like a little him.
And then he go, but then he's like, oh, we're becoming friends.
Right.
And then,
friends are dangerous things.
Yeah. Yep. Ugh.
Do you think Cavill in that moment was actually starting to feel something for the boy, and that's why he stabs him?
I think so. And I know we cast a little boy who looked plausibly like a young Dean Stockwell. Mm. We purposefully cast that little boy to look, and we know what young Dean Stockwell looked like because he was a kid actor.
Now, what stops Cavill here from, because he has some clear shots on her.
Yeah, he does.
But it's him.
And he considers, and I think it's that, he doesn't know. That's it. I remember now. It's because if he kills Kara, that won't kill the love. And he realizes that's what he really wants to kill. He can't kill the father, but he can't kill the father's girlfriend either, because it's not going to solve the problem. It's not going to make him beloved.
I feel like Cavill killing young John is the glorious bookend to Caprica 6 snuffing out an infant in its cradle.
Oh, Caprica, that was so mean of you.
I don't look at it as mean. I look at it as it was a mercy killing.
It's a tender mercy.
Yeah, mercy killing. And I've always thought there was some curiosity to it of like, how do these work? Oh, wow, they're fragile. Yeah.
a fascination to it. Yeah, yes. It was the first time it had she had seen and getting taken in by the kind of innocence of it and the fragility and the beauty that is a little tiny baby, right?
I forgive Caprica 6 everything because she went on such a journey. I have such distinct memories of us shooting this because I was out there all that night and it was so cold.
Oh,
and
the scene with Cavill and white coated 6.
Yes, white coated 6.
At least it wasn't Red Dress 6. That would have been freezing.
Oh, I can't imagine. It was she's freezing anyway. You just can't tell. It was very cold. But the walk back to like the area where there were like bathrooms and burritos was this beautiful walk through the woods, all illuminated by that weather balloon that was up there putting the light from overhead. It was very beautiful.
Yeah, it is interesting, those balloons.
Yeah,
the amount of light that they put out, but it's this, like you said, it's a beautiful light when you're walking through the trees, and you're like, this is surreal.
Yeah,
but
now the word that the silent occupation is over, and we've all called a truce, and oh, Cavill, he's a Cylon. What?
Oh, well,
jig is up.
I love it. Two Cavills. And now all the tricky stuff you have to do here with doubles and eye lines and stuff.
Yeah, it's technically it's hard to shoot, but lovely to see the result.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you
know, Eddie's been around for enough of it that he knows exactly how to do it. Like, yeah. All right, I've been on these stages with 19 Cylons before. Okay. This way, then this way, then this way, then this way.
I like how the Cavils are just like, we can admit our mistakes. Like, no, no harm done. It even says no harm done. Like Adama's like, you just annihilated our race. No harm done.
Yeah. And now they're getting philosophical. Enough. Let's airlock them both. Love Ty. Oh my God. He's the best.
Yeah. Put him on the airlock. It's in the fracking ship.
Ty is, sometimes you meet an actor and you're like, oh, I see why you're cast that way, because you're actually that person. Michael Hogan is so different than Ty. Yeah. Just this sort of sweet, hippie-hearted love machine. I just love him so much.
Yeah, he can slip into Ty so easily, though. Like when you see him, because his voice, he just does the Ty voice. But he is, yeah, he's just this beautiful man. You described him right, hippie-hearted man.
Yes, hippie-hearted. And here they are, the two Cavils going to be airlocked together.
Dean worked his butt off in this.
Oh God, yes.
Doing all the Capricas. That must have been, I mean, he's not a young man there.
No. Yeah, he's in tons and tons and tons of this. And he's so good. Is Dean still with us? Has Dean?
I believe he is.
Mm-hmm. Yay, Dean. Good.
I know. I have thought about this. He's been very quiet. But
he'll be back for the plan part two.
Yep.
Yeah.
He's just waiting.
I was just having the discussion between themselves. Do you really think it was a human or
a mistake?
Yeah.
Ideas only seem strange until you try them on, brother.
We had a temper tantrum in the form of a cataclysm because we wanted them to treasure us more than humanity. Yeah. It's all it was.
I did like, there's a line at the very end of that, and perfumed and told we were the princes of the universe. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, is Jane a Highlander fan, maybe?
No.
No,
I don't. The princes.
Queen's soundtrack, the lead song is Princes of the Universe.
Ah.
Highlander soundtrack.
Must have been in my subconscious.
Yes. I'm a fan, so I got it.
The anticipation is really unpleasant. See, that's the thing I love, is when someone is having a high level conversation that you can get back to the human thing of like I've got butterflies, you know, like,
right.
Why can't this happen faster?
And nobody wants to be alone at the end.
Yeah. And they have each other / themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And opening, there was a, when we saw it at the beginning, right? And there was a line I loved between the two of them. And where Cavil 1 says, no, I figured out what went wrong. And the Cavil 2 goes, well, that's a very useful revelation to have when you're standing in front of an airlock. Like, figured out now? Great. Like, we're going out. So, Dean did it very well, like doing the two of them when they're together like that.
Yeah. Harvey.
Yeah.
There was a little tribute to Harvey Friend there at the end, whom we all love. I agree. Dean stepping in to take over this big movie. He was great.
Yeah, he was lovely. I want to see him. Now it's made me want to see him.
Yeah. That was a treat, you know, because I remember watching it the first time around and not really having much of an emotional response beyond like, oh, this is cool. We're answering some questions. Mm-hmm. I get it.
Right.
But, you know, as we talked about last week with Mary, or last month or 2 months ago or half a year ago with Mary, you know, the feelings that one has about art changes as you evolve and grow as a person. And I remember not vibing with Kara just being an angel, you know, and disappearing, right. And the weird, just the leap of faith you have to take with that character, right. And that the finality of that journey. you know, 15 years ago when I first watched it, but now watching, it's like, oh no, I get it. Like, I understand it. I feel what the show was going for. And I've changed to the point where now I'm ready to receive that message. And so watching this again is still like, yeah, okay. Like, now I understand what it's doing. And I understand the point of the two Cavils and their twin evolutions and the sort of barnacling of one perspective and the softening of another. And so I definitely found myself more invested and more ultimately moved by it than I did the first time, which is the treat of this podcast. It's like, oh, hey, look at that.
Every production is a co-production between what's been created and your own brain. So it's all in how, it's as much about how we view it as what's on the screen. And and I feel like I got a new appreciation for that because I haven't watched that since I watched it.
Wow. So and that's what art is, right? It has its own, every individual has its own interpretation of it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right?
Depending on their own experiences.
Yeah.
That's right.
And that interpretation can change over time.
Yeah. Very much so.
Very much so.
Thank you guys for showing me that again.
Of course. So now we're going to do our frackdown of the episode, which is the part, you know, not good, not bad. It's the noteworthy moment of the episode that sticks out to you as one worth commenting upon.
I forgot to pick one.
You didn't pick one.
I forgot to pick one. This is like a special episode. I wasn't thinking about it. What's your fractal?
I have mine. Mine is as much as I like the Sam narrative and as much as I like the Cavil stuff, I was most moved, I think, by the Boomer stuff. By, you know, when Boomer says, look, I'm happier when I'm a human. Mm-hmm. You know, the tragedy of not being in control of who she is when she wants to be. And that Cavil ultimately is the engineer of her emotional state at any time or another, which then plays out later on. Like, there's this weird connection / repulsion between the two of them, based entirely on a wooden elephant statue. But that sentiment of, you know, I want to be this more than I am, and I'm happier when I'm this, even though I know it's what I'm not. I just found it very moving and kind of heartbreaking. So yeah, that's my frack down.
Okay. I'm just going to make one up, not make one up, but off the top of my head.
You can choose your own butt if you want.
I can choose my own butt. I will choose my own butt at that age. I was kind of like, oh, I don't know if I'd do that underwear shot anymore, but, the last scene with the Cavils, and kind of what you just described, Mark, of the story throughout the movie is seeing the story as you just said, the hardening of one and the softening of the other, of what they kind of were going through in that time period that this took place. And I just liked seeing that of because it explains so much of just what people go through and how their experiences shape their worldview. Mm-hmm. And what they're, so it was very, to me, very a human to see the two have their experiences shaped differently.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
I didn't really make sense there, but.
No, I like it. And I was going to pick something, I was going to pick the same thing. I was going to pick the two of them in the airlock. That the one Cavil has changed his mind because he's realized. This is just us wanting to be loved. We didn't have to kill all these people.
And then the idea that the other Cavil's like, well, I'm going to have you boxed as soon as we wake up. It's like, let's cauterize this emotional vein, you know, right away, lest you infect anybody else. And even still, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yay. Well, thank you, Jane.
Yes. Thank you for joining.
Thank
for a long one too. We kind of like, okay, we got her. For 2 hours.
Squeezed every last bit.
Oh, that was great. I love that. I'm so glad you got me on.
Absolutely. So yes, thank you, Jane, for taking time out of your day. Thank you to the good folks at Sci-Fi Wire for letting us indulge ourselves to the lengths to which they do. Thank you to Bear McCreary for the kick-ass theme song. And thank you to Brett Boehm for making us sound good. And as always, thank you to you, Tricia Helfer.
Yeah, I'm back at you. Thank you to you, Mark.
Yay. And so we will, until the next time, be good, be safe, wear a mask. So say we all.
So say we all.